You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, reunited with international correspondent Claudia Farhat. Nice to see you again, Claudia.
Hello, Kat. Great to be back with you. And wow, what an episode for us to do together.
I know.
A podcast planned and just about ready to go out before news that a Gaza peace deal has just been reached came. So we've just rushed both of us back onto Zoom to bring you the latest updates on that one.
Yes, there'll be plenty to unpack there. But it's also been a big week in France after the new PM's shock resignation. We'll check in with our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, for the latest.
And Australia has signed its first pact in more than 70 years, plus a big list of grievances as the US Supreme Court convenes a new term. Should we expect more polarising verdicts on everything from Trump's tariffs to executive orders on citizenship birthrights?
But first, to the Gaza peace deal. It seems that after 2 years, almost to the day, of war in Gaza, both Hamas and Israel have signed off on a deal to end the fighting. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has to get his cabinet to sign off on it, which is due to happen shortly. But by all accounts, and there have been a lot of people involved in these latest talks, it will happen, Claudia.
Yeah, Kat, it's certainly looking that way. We've already seen pictures of people celebrating in both Gaza and in Israel, although I think for a lot of us who've been covering this war for the past 2 years, we're still sort of waiting with bated breath because there's still a lot that can happen. As we know, as we've talked about on this podcast so often in such sort of tense and fragile negotiations. But according to an Israeli official, all of the hostages will be released in the next day or two, although not necessarily the bodies of the dead hostages, as Hamas has now said that they don't know where all of them are. As part of that deal, Israeli forces will also pull back, but it is still unclear exactly where to. And all the other big elements of Donald Trump's so-called 20-point peace plan are going to be dealt with later. But I think if we just pause at what's been achieved at this point, this first stage agreement, I think it is astonishing, really, that they've managed to bridge even those gaps to date. I mean, Trump seems to have gotten both sides to agree to some pretty serious concessions here. On the part of the Israelis, for Benjamin Netanyahu, I mean, this is the first time we're not hearing him explicitly insisting that he's going to reserve the right to restart the war until all of his war goals are achieved. We've always heard him say that in the past. We're not hearing it now. And on Hamas's part, they're now negotiating a plan that explicitly demands their disarmament. Yes, that's not what they've agreed to today in this first phase of the deal, but the fact that they've agreed to the first phase of a deal that does call for that, the fact that they're in Sharm el-Sheikh, shows that they're at least considering it. After this deal was agreed to, this first phase, Netanyahu put out a statement saying it was, quote, a great day for Israel, and that with the help of the Almighty, we will continue to achieve all our goals and expand peace with our neighbours. So note, he called it goals there, not war goals, which is a change from what we've seen in the past. So as ever, there's a fair amount of room for interpretation with that statement. But now I think it really is down to the actions on the ground, which we should see unfold over the course of the next few days. And I think there are still a few things that might turn into problems. The first is this issue of Israeli withdrawal. Donald Trump says both sides need to agree to a time frame and sort of a staged withdrawal. White House maps are showing that's going to happen sort of to 50%, then to 40%. But then they're still showing a permanent security buffer taking up about 15% of the Gaza Strip. We know that Hamas wants them out completely. So I don't think that's an issue that's been resolved just yet. And then there's the question of how Gaza is going to be governed in the future. Donald Trump says he's going to lead this transitional body, the Board of Peace, until the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has reformed and can take over the Gaza Strip. But Benjamin Netanyahu insists he's never going to allow that to happen. And in the meantime, it's sort of unclear how much involvement Palestinians are going to have. Other than Hamas representatives, it's not even clear that they've been in Sharm el-Sheikh this week while all of this is being talked through. And I think arguably the biggest question probably that Hamas is asking right now is what's going to hold Israel to account after the hostages are released, because that is what analysts see as sort of Hamas's last bargaining chip. And if they are released in the next 72 hours, what's to say that the rest of the deal is going to be seen through? So as ever, who knows how this is going to proceed, even if this first phase does go ahead, Kat.
Yeah, it's certainly hard to be overly optimistic, even now after we hear of news of this first phase being agreed upon. Trump has said he'll be heading to the region in the coming days, though, and the first sign of the breakthrough came when he was holding court at a meeting about Antifa and what he describes as the radical left. He was actually handed a note by his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, which the cameras caught a glimpse of, saying a deal was very close and he should authorize a social media post so he could be the first one to announce that deal. It seemed at that point it was down to the final list of Palestinian prisoners to be released. So Israel will release 250 serving life sentences and 1,700 Gazans held since the October 7 attacks. That's including women and children. The contention is likely to be around some of the prominent Palestinian prisoners, like Marwan al-Baqouti, being held for 5 life terms and widely seen as the most credible person to lead any future Palestinian governing body. Although, of course, Israel has always insisted they wouldn't allow him to participate, Claudia.
Yeah, Bahuti was an organizer in both intifadas and he set up Fatah's armed wing. So he's sort of become a national symbol for a lot of Palestinians. And he's arguably Israel's highest profile prisoner and evidently, Kat, not one that they were willing to give up.
And it's important to note, I mean, as we flagged at the beginning, this is all happening very close to the October 7 anniversary, and Israelis marked that anniversary across the country, despite their government delaying official remembrances until after the Jewish Harvest Festival. So we saw quite a spectacular scene as tens of thousands gathered in Tel Aviv's Central Park for the main event, while at the same time, a group of protesters assembled outside the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem, calling for the release of all those hostages still held captive. The Prime Minister is still likely to face resistance from the far-right members of his cabinet, who have been threatening to bring down government if Israel agrees to a peace deal.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see their reaction now that he has agreed to this first phase, I think, Kat. And Netanyahu has been accused over and over by his opponents within Israel of prolonging this war for his own gain, right? To keep those far-right coalition partners happy, to delay his ongoing corruption trial, which we've chatted about before, and to not concede on those long-held war goals. So I guess the concern this week has been that those will be considerations for him in this round of talks too. On some of those personal considerations, there was another interesting development out of Israel in the past week. The Israeli President Isaac Herzog suggested he's considering pardoning Netanyahu in his corruption cases. He said he was going to make that decision based on what's best for the Israeli public, right, for the good of the country. Those charges could have seen him serve jail time. I wonder if that's not the Israeli president offering Netanyahu some sort of off-ramp here, right? Off-ramp to the wall. And if that did end up being a consideration for him in agreeing to this latest deal.
And another thing we can't ignore, despite this breaking news, is the international flotilla. There have been rallies in lots of cities across the world supporting them after those involved were detained by Israel, especially following accounts of abusive treatment, many detained in one of Israel's most notorious prisons. That's including 7 Australians who have now been deported to Jordan. There were a number of prominent figures involved, and perhaps most recognizable is Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. And she was really trying to flip the narrative away from their experiences to what she described as the real story in Gaza. Here's a bit of what she had to say arriving in Greece after being deported by Israel.
And this is a last resort. That this mission has to exist is a shame. It is a shame. And I could talk for a very, very long time about our mistreatment and abuses in our imprisonment, trust me. But that is not the story. What happened here was that Israel, while continuing to worsen and escalate their genocide and mass destruction with genocidal intent, attempting to erase an entire population, an entire nation in front of our very eyes.
Israeli authorities have since come out to deny the claims of mistreatment.
En ce lundi matin,
this Monday morning, the conditions were no longer in place for me to carry out the duties of Prime Minister and allow the government to appear before the National Assembly tomorrow. The composition of the government was not smooth and awakened some partisan appetites, sometimes quite legitimately linked to the upcoming presidential election.
That was Sébastien Lecornu speaking, who became the shortest-lived Prime Minister in modern French history when he announced he'd be stepping down just 14 hours after he formed his new cabinet, blaming lawmakers for refusing to compromise to find a way out of the country's debt crisis. Emmanuel Macron is now looking for his fourth prime minister in just 10 months, and the pressure is only growing from both the left and the right for him to either call another snap parliamentary election or to step down altogether. Well, for more on this, I've been speaking with our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis.
Hello, Claudia. I was going to say bonjour, but I'm actually sitting in London rather than Paris, as lovely as that would be.
Close enough, Ben, close enough. Let's start with Macron's reaction to all of this. He's asked Lecornu to stay on to try to negotiate a way out of this with the parliament's competing blocs, but that seems like a pretty big ask, right?
Yeah, it's a huge ask, and it's been tried before with a number of prime ministers all trying to do the same thing, cobble together some sort of working majority. Now, Lecornu has spoken not long ago saying, look, we are making some progress here at trying to resolve this crisis, that there is a will among the conservative-leaning parties to get a budget together for the next year. Currently, there isn't one. He now needs to speak to the left-leaning party. So that's going to happen over the next few days. The hope is, from Macron's point of view, that the outgoing prime minister may not stay in post, but he might be able to put together some sort of government. Now, the reason that he stepped down is actually not due to the far right bloc in parliament or the far left. It's actually his own bloc. So the government was essentially made up of Emmanuel Macron's party, Renaissance, which is sort of a centre-right party, more centrist maybe. And then there's the Republicans, which is a centre-right party. They took issue with some of the cabinet picks that Lecornu had made and said, we are not going to support this. Now, they might be easier to get back on board. The challenge is they need to pick up enough lawmakers from either side to make sure they've got a stable majority in parliament, because stability is something that France desperately needs right now.
And this was already a massive crisis for Emmanuel Macron, you know, going through so many prime ministers in such a short period of time. It's now only turning into a bigger one. What options do you think the president has left?
Yeah, none of them are great options for President Macron. And just after the prime minister resigned, there were these amazing shots of the French president going for a little solo stroll along the Seine, contemplating perhaps his political decisions he has to make. Yes, he could get a new prime minister, select one and cobble together some sort of government that continues on. But again, stability is going to be a problem there. He could call for new parliamentary elections. However, there's no guarantee he's going to get the result or the clarity he wants. Polls suggest it could be another sort of three-way tie between the left, the right, and the more centrists. And then there is the nuclear option of resignation. He has said repeatedly that he is going to serve out his full term, which ends in 2027. One of his former prime ministers, Edouard Philippe, this week said he thinks perhaps it is time for Macron to consider stepping down. It seems unlikely that will happen, but you never know. If things come to complete gridlock, we see more protests in the streets, the country's, you know, debt crisis spirals, he might have no choice.
Yeah, and say he was to give in to some of those pressures to say the call elections or resign, it seems like France's far-right parties would only stand to gain from that as well.
Yeah, that is the assumption. Leading in the polls at the moment is the National Rally, the party of Marine Le Pen, the perennial presidential candidate, now led by Jordan Bardella, who's a much younger, very charismatic figure. They've been doing very well in the polls. However, think back to the snap parliamentary elections we had in 2024 called by Emmanuel Macron. Sure, the far right did well in the first round. In the second round, that sort of that block, that grouping together of the centrists, the left, the conservatives who don't like Le Pen, they all got together. And in the end, it was actually the far left block that won the most seats. So there's no guarantee that the National Rally would win in a new parliamentary election. And as I said, the poll suggests it could just be another sort of roughly a tie between the three major blocs. which would not help Emmanuel Macron at all.
Tumultuous times in French politics, but thanks so much for talking us through it all today, Ben.
This treaty elevates the relationship between our two nations to the status of an alliance. It is Australia's first new alliance in more than 70 years.
I want to say this treaty is just the beginning of the next phase in our nations, two nations relationship.
Australia entered into its first alliance in more than 70 years this week, elevating the relationship with Papua New Guinea in the hopes of improving regional security. The Puk Puk Treaty, named after the local word for crocodile, includes a mutual defence pact that commits either nation to helping the other in the event of an armed attack. To take us through the details and what it means for the Pacific, we're joined by SBS political correspondent Naveen Razik. Naveen, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Just how significant is this agreement?
It's quite significant. It's been something that's been in the works for some time. It was actually an idea that was pitched by Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape to the Australian government. And it signifies a shift in some of the thinking in Papua New Guinea as well. I was speaking to one analyst yesterday who said that effectively Papua New Guinea's foreign policy has for a long time been friends to all, enemies to none. And they're still sticking by that. But there has been a shift in terms of suggesting that maybe some friends, when it comes to some relationships around defence, are more special than others. And of course, Australia and Papua New Guinea have a long relationship. Obviously, as well, Australian troops fought in Papua New Guinea alongside locals as well during the Second World War. And that sort of history has been used to sort of help cement and build this pact. It will effectively allow Australian troops to operate in Papua New Guinea and also give training opportunities for Papua New Guinea defence forces in Australia as well. But it also includes that mutual defence treaty. And that, of course, is very significant. It's very rare for both countries effectively to commit to defending each other. And that's the commitment that was made. It took a while to sign. We expected it to be signed a few weeks ago in Port Moresby during the anniversary celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Papua New Guinea's independence. That didn't happen. The reason why, given out by the government at least, was that the cabinet was separated at some raucous celebrations across the country. They all couldn't get in the room to give it the final tick of approval. That didn't come until last week, and the signature finally came on Monday here in Canberra.
And Nav, we want to chat to you a bit more about those mutual support obligations, what it means if either country comes under attack, including that commitment that the two nations are going to act to meet the common danger. What do you think that means for any possible conflict with China?
That is still an open question that both leaders have kind of skirted around. Marape, in an interview at 7:30 after that treaty was signed, effectively suggested that that wouldn't draw his country into conflict with China, that sovereignty would be respected. And that's something that Anthony Albanese has also said as well. But there are still a lot of questions around that. And this process has to go through both the parliaments of Australia, where there is bipartisan support, but also the parliament of Papua New Guinea. And there is some concern from opposition voices, the opposition leader in particular, about what this means for Papua New Guinea's sovereignty as well, whether it would mean they get drawn into a hypothetical conflict with China. Interesting to note that there are two other allies with whom we have mutual defence agreements. One is New Zealand and the other is the United States. That's under the ANZUS Treaty, which was the last treaty that Australia signed before this one. That has only been invoked once, and that was after the September 11 attacks. It was invoked 3 days later by John Howard's government, effectively putting Australia alongside the US in their response in the war on terror. So that is the one situation where this has happened before. That's as an example. It's still, unknown where this could lead to, but Marape has said quite clearly he does not want this treaty to lead to his country being dragged into war. He thinks it's all about keeping the peace within the region.
And this isn't the only deal in the works. There's a new bilateral security treaty with Fiji on the cards, and the government has just announced an expanded partnership with Singapore. There's obviously a lot going on here. Could you talk us through these partnerships?
Yeah, so the Singapore one came through this morning as part of a suite of different strategic partnerships, but in particular a focus on security. And I asked Singapore's Prime Minister Lawrence Wong for a bit more detail on exactly what this could mean. Could this mean that we see Australian troops rotate through Singapore and Australian assets rotate through Singapore in the same way that US Marines rotate through Darwin? He said the details are still being worked out, but ultimately this is about giving Australia greater access and great to that region, and ideally to improve the stability and security of the region as well. And we know that China is also a big player in the Asia Pacific. I was in PIF a few weeks ago and we sort of saw that all play out. One journalist told me that the Solomon Islands is ground zero. That's the host country. The Solomon Islands was ground zero for the diplomatic tussle. Australia, if you drive around Honiara, you can see where the different aid from international aid organisations is. This is a very poor country, so it relies on a lot of international support. The Australians sponsored the bus stops, they sponsored the highways, they built the highways, but China had probably the most ornate gift in the National Stadium, which hosted some of those Pacific Islands Forum events. It hosted the media centre during that event as well. The leaders at the Pacific Islands Forum were driven around not in Australian donated cars, but in Chinese made cars that included the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. So even at these sorts of forums, you can see where the different presence of different allies and factions and sort of rivals is all coming together. Australia, during that visit, Australia was hoping before then to sign a treaty with Vanuatu, but that has also been delayed. And the reason why that was delayed was concerns over sovereignty, and in particular whether Australia could veto critical infrastructure deals Vanuatu would like to sign with China as well. Where Australia is having better luck is with Fiji. Sitiveni Rabuka, the country's prime minister, has been pushing for this ocean of peace idea, this idea to get the region aligned on security issues. And within that push as well, he also expressed interest at Honiara in Australia and Fiji signing a security relationship. Important to note, there are only three fully formed militaries in the Pacific. Papua New Guinea is one of them, the largest country in the Pacific. Fiji is the other, Tonga a third as well. So there were questions to the Prime Minister on Monday about whether a Fijian pact would also have that mutual defence clause. The Prime Minister wouldn't say, just that these issues were being worked through as well. He's also expressed confidence that that strategic agreement, which involves some security guarantees as well with Vanuatu, will get over the line. But there's a lot of scepticism about the reality of the fact that that could be quite difficult to secure.
A lot going on in our region, Nav. So thanks so much for coming on the pod to chat about it all with us this week.
Thank you.
So in case you were concerned, there wasn't enough chaos in the US at the moment. The Trump administration has a whole slew of cases either already pending at the Supreme Court or making their way there. And the court has resumed after the summer break. The Republican-heavy court has already given Trump wins on mass federal layoffs, immigration raids relying on race or ethnicity, and withholding foreign aid, although they did decline to let Trump's administration withhold payments to foreign aid organisations for work they had already done for the government, Claudia.
Yeah, and a big one still to come is the legality of Trump's sweeping global tariffs. Mm. This is a centerpiece of his America First vision. The Justice Department is appealing a lower court's ruling that Trump has overstepped his authority in imposing most of his tariffs under a federal law meant for emergencies. Trillions of dollars in customs duties over the next decade are at stake here, not to mention the Trump administration's credibility. Arguments on that one are scheduled for November 5.
And a ruling that really gets right to the heart of what it means to be American is also due. The court was asked to decide on the legality of Trump's bid to limit birthright citizenship. It's a major test of one of his most contentious policies that could alter how the US Constitution has long been understood on the subject and is a key part of Trump's hardline approach towards immigration that we're consistently seeing. The administration had directed federal agencies to refuse to recognise the citizenship of US-born children who do not have at least one parent who is an American citizen or lawful permanent resident, also known as a green card holder.
Yeah, but probably the most contentious court battle happening in the US right now is about the use of National Guard troops in cities across the country. So troops from the Texas National Guard have just arrived in Illinois, just outside Chicago, as part of what the Trump administration says is a push to crack down on crime in Democrat-led cities, something they repeatedly say is bogus, as they actually don't have the highest crime rates nationally. And just a week after telling the entire military top brass the enemy was within, he has now suggested he could use the Insurrection Act to circumvent restrictions on using the military as a domestic force. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is visiting Portland in Oregon just days after a judge blocked the deployment of federalized National Guard troops to the city. And the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, has been facing questions from senators about those deployments, as well as over the migrant arrests that have sparked protests in neighborhoods where they're happening, probably not helped by the filmed deployment of U.S. Border Patrol agents rappelling from Black Hawk helicopters onto rooftops and breaking down doors in a Chicago apartment block last week, Kat, an operation that authorities said was targeting gang members, but which swept up U.S. citizens and families as well.
Yep, another astonishing example of the administration really doubling down on their anti-migrant show of force. And it may just be having an effect, Claudia. Illegal crossings at the US-Mexico border have hit the lowest level in over half a century. That's according to federal data obtained by CBS News. And now for a look at some other big stories that have flown under the radar this week. The International Criminal Court has convicted a former commander of Sudan's notorious Janjaweed militia over atrocities committed in Darfur more than 20 years ago. Ali Mohammed Ali Abdul Rahman, also known as Ali Kusheib, was found guilty of 27 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, torture and attacks on civilians. The conviction is the first by the ICC over past crimes committed during the conflict in Darfur, which lasted from 2003 to 2020.
Abdul Rahman was a leading member of the Janjaweed, a militia armed by the Sudanese government that carried out widespread attacks on Darfur's non-Arab population. The court heard harrowing details from witnesses who described instances of horrific violence, both ordered and perpetrated by Abdul Rahman. The former commander denied all charges and claimed to have been wrongly identified. The conviction comes as similar violence has since returned to the region amid Sudan's ongoing civil war, with many former Janjaweed fighters now members of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
And direct flights will resume between China and India later this month for the first time in 5 years, signalling more easing of bilateral tensions. Flights between the two countries were suspended during the COVID pandemic, you might recall, but they never restarted following deadly troop clashes along a disputed section of a border in the Himalayas. The news was announced by India's foreign ministry, who said it was part of the government's approach towards a gradual normalisation of relations between Beijing and New Delhi.
The move comes just a month after India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited China for the first time in 7 years to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Modi and Chinese President Xi Jinping both agreed that the two countries were development partners and not rivals, and discussed ways to boost trade ties amid global tariff uncertainty. Flights are expected to resume from October 26. India's largest airline, IndiGo, has so far confirmed just the one route between Kolkata and Guangzhou.
Japan's new PM, Sene Takaichi, was a pink-haired rocker in her youth. But don't let that fool you into thinking this equates to left-leaning radical politics. In fact, as a fan of the late Margaret Thatcher, Takaichi prides herself on becoming Japan's Iron Lady and doesn't seem intent on challenging much of the country's patriarchal values.
And Czechia's new populist billionaire prime minister has an idol of his own. Andrej Babiš's ANO party won the parliamentary election over the weekend, but fell short of a majority. Babiš is a self-declared Trump supporter who seized on the country's economic frustrations, which he attributed largely to excessive spending on the war in Ukraine. And in a country that hasn't had anything approaching a free election in a generation or longer, arguably, the preliminary results were announced from Syria's first election since the fall of the al-Assad regime last year. The parliament is overwhelmingly Sunni Muslim and male. Only six of the new members are women, and just 10 belong to ethnic and religious minorities. This lack of representation reflected also in the fact that elections were suspended in zones outside of the government's control.
Yeah, it's being hailed as a big step forward to democracy, but as you say, Claudia, some pretty big flaws, not least the candidates being elected by an electoral college in each region, so no universal suffrage just yet.
Forever and ever.
Okay, for those of you unfamiliar with that incredibly creepy audio, that's an infamous scene from The Shining and the malevolent ghosts that roam the corridors of the Overlook Hotel. So, Kat, I have a question for you. Would you stay at a haunted hotel?
No.
Okay, well, maybe a better question then. How desperate are you for $5,000?
Pretty desperate, to be honest, actually.
Well, I have good news for you. You might just be the ideal applicant for ghost hunting in the storied halls of Las Vegas's oldest casino. The legendary El Cortez Hotel and Casino is offering up a job for anyone seemingly unfazed by a basement reportedly full of ashes and cremated remains of former employees.
Ooh.
And haunted by mobsters, get this, like Bugsy Siegel and his former henchman, Fat Irish.
Are you suggesting that I might be related to Fat Irish because I'm Irish? Because I'm pretty sure I have no family ties to Green.
No, there's no profiling going on here, and I sure hope you don't, because it is believed that the gangster lived in the hotel free of charge right up until his death, and many now believe he continues to haunt the residence to this day, with employees reporting paranormal sightings from disembodied hands reaching into their rooms and loud knocks heard on unoccupied hotel floors, Kat.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm very much still like a knock on wood superstitious person, and I'm not that desperate for $5,000, let me put it that way.
I think we could do it together. You know, we could team up, we could hunt ghosts, make podcasts in our
off time. I was going to say.
We could split the 5K.
Yeah, I mean, we could record the podcast from there, have a bit of Atmos. I like it.
Special haunted hotel edition.
Oh. Well,
before we go, Kat, one other thing we want to mention. The Nobel Peace Prize is being awarded this week. Will Donald Trump secure the recognition he thinks he deserves for all the conflicts he says he's resolved?
Well, it's quite an impressive list, Claudia. Let me list it out for you. Israel and Iran, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Armenia and Azerbaijan, Thailand and Cambodia, India and Pakistan, Egypt and Ethiopia, Serbia and Kosovo, although importantly, most, if not all, either didn't involve Trump, are unchanged, or didn't have a conflict.
Details, Kat, details.
It's all in the details. But if the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas holds, he'll be focusing on that as a win, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's an equally impressive list of past recipients from Mother Teresa to Mikhail Gorbachev and, of course, Barack Obama. So we'll just have to stay tuned for that announcement.
Indeed.
But for now, that is The World This Week. If you're enjoying the pod, don't forget to like and subscribe to World News Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes will drop every Thursday. Catch you next time, Kat.
See you soon, Claudia.